Look at the adjective. Play.
I respect you, Booker man.
And I have half the brain that you do.
Right.
A shot.
I told you. Told you.
Now is the franchise going to take the Viagra?
Hello there, wrestling fans, and welcome back to Because WCW, the podcast where the big boys play. And this time around, we are looking at the legendary WCW Uncensored 1996. Yes, indeed, that's the one with the Doomsday Cage. I am, as ever, joined by my co-host, sports journalist and blue tick man, Liam Happ. Liam, how you doing?
I am very blue ticky, I suppose.
Excellent. Have you survived the snowfall that we have had recently?
I have. I've emerged relatively unscathed, just really pissed off at it. But it does sound like I have had a marginally better week than yourself.
I've not had a classic, it has to be said. Apart from the fact that I have been battling a cough, cold and general man flu, I did manage to drop a hot grill pan onto my hand the other day and have now got grooves in my hand that resemble Abdullah the Butcher's forehead.
To cap all things off, some git made you watch Uncensored 96, I believe.
Yeah, that's true. I was meant to be going up to Edinburgh to both visit a friend and visit Discovery Wrestling as well. And obviously, the snow put paid to all of that. And Discovery had to cancel their show. And I had to go to work instead. So, yeah, sucks to be me. But hey, this country, hey, what can you say? And then, as you say, Liam, I had to watch WCW Uncensored. And my God, what a show that was. And I don't say that in the good way either.
Oh, yeah, we've covered so many different types of shit so far, haven't we? We've done the Vince Russo madness. We've just done a Kevin Sullivan in the early 2000s, which was probably the worst week over week period of WCW. We've done some flat out abysmal pay per views, and the general consensus of this one is that there definitely are worse pay per views. But when it's punctuated by the main event, it's hard to look past it as one of the worst times in the history of this amazing company.
Indeed it is. But we'll get to all that later. However, it wasn't just you and me who were watching this show. Because once again, we are joined by a guest. And I'm very pleased to say that my good friend from Hooked on Wrestling and the Hooked on Wrestling podcast, I believe he's known as Showbiz, Paul Benson, is with me. Hello, Paul. How you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Dean. Thank you for that nice intro. And guys, thank you for having me on. I've been listening to this podcast since your very first episode.
And you Dean, poor
Dean
sod.
I'll tell you, mostly entertaining, Liam, when you're talking. and I've been badgering Dean to have me on. And my trip fell victim to the weather this week as well. So what a perfect week to cheer me up by watching Uncensored.
So basically what we're saying is, for both you and me, Paul, rather than being on holiday, we've been stuck at home watching WCW Uncensored.
Correct. I should have been by rights sat in a nice bar by a nice harbour in Lanzarote tonight, sipping a cocktail. And instead I'm sat in my office recovering from the post-traumatic stress of watching a Giant Haystacks Big Show match.
Oh, dear. And what a classic that was, bless him. So if people don't know about you and about Hooked on Wrestling, tell the good folks here in Because WCW, what is Hooked on Wrestling all about?
So Hooked on Wrestling started life about 5 years ago when a few of us decided that we would quite like to see what it was like watching some WWE pay-per-views in a bar surrounded by a few of our fellow friends. So we gave it a go for Royal Rumble 2013, and a few people turned up at this bar in Shepherd's Bush. And then we did it again for WrestleMania, and we had 100 or so people there, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. And now for WrestleMania 34 on April the 8th, we're actually going to be running 22 parties across the UK in bars and clubs, in towns and cities, to get hundreds or thousands of wrestling fans in to all celebrate the biggest night in wrestling together and watch WWE pay-per-views together, get drunk, do a quiz, and dress up like our favourite wrestlers. So that, in a nutshell, is Hooked on Wrestling.
It is crazy. I mean, I went to the one that you ran for the Royal Rumble in Clapham, at the Clapham Ground, which obviously is a venue yep. that we visit as part of IPW Wrestling. And it was crazy. 450 people crammed into this venue to watch a show that basically began at midnight.
Oh, it's insane. Our record for, I believe it was WrestleMania 31. No, sorry, I tell a lie, WrestleMania 32. We had 650 people in the Walkabout Temple, which was just bonkers. Bonkers. So yeah, it's always a great night. I won't run through all the town cities because we have got a podcast to record. But if anyone wants any information on where we're having an event, probably near you somewhere, you just need to go to facebook.com/HO Wrestling, look at the events page there, and check out what we're all about. It's as you'll know, Dean, I don't think you've been to one of our events yet, Liam, but
I have actually.
Have you? I know yeah. you went to the Bruce Pritchard one, but I didn't think you'd been to any of our
Royal Rumble 2013. SummerSlam 2013, yeah. WrestleMania 30, which was obviously a highlight. It was a great one to be in the pub for. I think my last one was Royal Rumble 2015. I don't want you to think that the results of that pay-per-view were what put me off. It was just the fact that not long after, my wife fell pregnant. So opportunity's been very slim since then.
Yeah, I think I understand that. I had my little boy around the same time, but luckily I tell my wife that it's paying for the new ensuite bathroom, so I get away with it.
Oh, yes.
Now, I've got to say, you do yourself a bit of a disservice here, Paul, because you said, how did this first start off? Because this is such a good story. How did the initial party, before there was ever anyone, this is such a good story.
Okay, so before I did all this, one of my roles, I worked for an agency that represented TNA, or Impact Wrestling's international TV rights. So my job was to sell their program around the world for, you know, my sins. This is when it was actually quite good. So every year for the sort of 3 years that they overlapped, their UK tours just happened to be on the same weekend as the Royal Rumble. It became a bit of a tradition, and amongst our group of friends, there's Joel Ross amongst them, and we used to go to his flat. After the TNA tour, the day after it finished, and watch the Royal Rumble, get dressed up again in fancy dress, the big boss man or the Mountie or Rowdy Roddy Piper or whatever it was, and watch the Rumble together, six or seven of us acting like fools. And Joel left London and left us high and dry, the selfish bastard, and we were left to find another venue. So it was then that I said to Rob McNichol, my co-host and Hooked on Wrestling, why don't I get a bar to show it and we'll charge people to come in? And I finally found an unwitting bar in Shepherd's Bush, the Belushis there, who agreed to it. And that was how it really started. We had 70 people come onto that first one. I was dressed as a bushwhacker. I don't think I made it to the main event without passing out drunk. And my best friend got Zack Ryder, woo, 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 written all over his face while he was passed out. So it was a cracker, as Liam will attest. I've just found out it was an interesting start.
So basically, we have gone from a few people gathered together in Joel Ross's old flat in Camden with the giant Scooby-Doo and Vince the Cat to now 22 cities around the UK.
Yes, and potentially a couple in Canada as well. We're expecting about 3,500 people in for WrestleMania in total.
Wow. Wow. And I was going to say, and that is obviously how you and I got to know each other, through your working with Challenge TV and TNA. And I think you had a hand in getting WrestleTalk TV on the air as well, if memory serves me right.
Yeah, that was my deal. That was my persuasive nature badgering Challenge TV for enough time, and eventually they got so sick of the sight of me darkening the door of their office that they signed over a meagre budget that was probably equivalent to their biscuit budget for the quarter, and gave us it to make a TV show talking about wrestling. So and then you know, all credit to those guys, they've gone from meagre beginnings there to this monstrous YouTube channel, so fair play to them. I'm It was great to play a little part in it, but they've really taken the ball and run with it. I can't claim any credit for that at all.
If you are interested in coming to one of the WrestleMania parties, go to facebook.com/HO Wrestling, or it's also on Twitter at HO Wrestling, I think, isn't it?
HO_Wrestling
for Twitter. There you go. Right, let's kick things off. WCW Uncensored 96. Now, we always like to start off with Schiavone Watch, to see what level of hyperbole he will start with. And Tony Schiavone this time around kicks things off by informing us that you're going to see some of the most shocking, some of the most uncensored wrestling action you'll see anywhere or have seen anywhere in the entire world, which is probably because no other wrestling company than WCW would be stupid enough to put a main event together like this one. Our commentators, along with Tony, are Dusty Rhodes and Bobby Heenan. The captions on screen have Dusty and Bobby the wrong way around, which is a great start. But there's an even better start to that, because, Liam, you found a bit of information about what happened before we went on air.
Yeah, a fun little anecdote from The Observer, funnily enough. Mr. Heenan's not really dressed for the show.
He's in a leather jacket, isn't he?
Yeah. So it turns out that he and a couple of other guys had a bit of a panic trip to the pay-per-view, which is in Tupelo, Mississippi. And they flew in on the day from Memphis. And they apparently got lost on their way driving from Memphis to Tupelo, which D.A. Price 82, who is a very famous, renowned Redditor on the Squared Circle Reddit subreddit, who does an amazing recap of old Dave Meltzer Observers and digests them down and adds a little bit of colour in it. He's a Memphis native, and he said, like, that is one of the easiest drives you'll ever have to do, and he can't believe that they got lost. This brain trust that got lost was Heenan, Gene Okerlund and Ric Flair.
There's a car full, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a car I love to be a part of, especially if they're getting lost and panicking about missing the pay-per-view. There's a fly-on-the-wall scenario if you ever wanted one.
Amazing. But they got there in time. This is the main thing.
Yeah, Heenan got there in time to see the several glances of utter disdain Schiavone seemed to be throwing towards Big Dust. And it starts on this opening spill. It looks like every time Dusty's talking, Schiavone leans right into Heenan, almost like I can imagine that Dusty spits while he talks. I don't know what the deal was there, but you could visibly see Schiavone trying to get as far away as he can while sat between the two men while on camera.
It is very noticeable. It is very noticeable, yes, to be said. So we kick things off with what, you know, on paper should be a really good opener. It's for the US heavyweight title. It's actually the only title match on the show. And it's the smiling, high-flying babyface Eddie Guerrero against the champion Conan. So Guerrero comes out, and as you pointed out to me, Liam, he's called a young man by Schiavone about three times whilst he walks to the ring. And while he's adept at this role, it's a bit generic, it's a bit blah, and it's nowhere near as good as the lying, cheating, stealing character in the WWE. Conan comes out with his name misspelt on the on-screen caption, so that's another good start for our caption people. Dressed like some sort of Technicolor version of Biggles, wearing some odd goggles. And then to add to our technical woes, referee Randy Anderson holds the belt up to a ringside camera, so of course the director never cuts to that camera view at all. This one's odd. It starts off with just zero reaction. And they're going hold for hold, mostly on the mat, to virtual silence. Dusty Rhodes is terrible on commentary. Conan's got an Achilles tendon hold on at one point, and Dusty talks about how it can break your ankle, which it won't, because your ankle needs to bend the other way for that. And interrupts himself and stutters and sounds a bit sort of like Porky Pig or Foghorn Leghorn. But then the match heats up when they start kind of being less sporting themselves and going nose to nose and shoving one another. The crowd reacts to this. They start chanting Eddie. The action speeds up. We get some more mat work, and then we have a Hurricane Rana and a plancher to the outside from Eddie onto Conan. The crowd come alive. Schiavone was reacting, saying he's never seen moves like this before. Now, I guess because we're watching this with 2018 eyes, I'm thinking, really? But I suppose in 1996, this was in WCW. This was a reasonably unusual move because it wasn't what you saw commonly. And the reactions, this kind of paved the way for the Lucha style to come in and people like Rey Mysterio Jr. to come in. The finish is pretty unique. Eddie goes up for a leapfrog, doesn't get high enough. His groin lands on Conan's head. Eddie falls down in agony. Conan opportunistically goes for the pin. Conan tries to shake hands. Eddie pushes him away. It's an up and down match to me. It was given plenty of time, 18 minutes. Your winner in the opener is Conan. Paul, what were your thoughts on this one?
I went in with really strong expectations, as you would, from a Conan-Eddie match. I find it really remarkable to see both of these guys in the guises that they're in, specifically Conan. When I first started watching WCW, which was just a few months after this, Conan had gone on to sort of that hip-hop look, hadn't he? And I never saw this look till a lot later. And he always just makes me think that he's come late from a fancy dress party. When he turns up, but you know, really, that's what he wore for the majority of his career in Mexico, I think. So it's kind of me that's out of line rather than him. But I like you mentioned that this match sort of started off quite slow and methodical, and I was quite surprised the first 5 minutes or so really, really dragged. And I thought this was going to be one of those times where it was a bit of a clash of styles or the crowd's not being into it. But then by the end of it, as they started bringing that frustration and that tension into it, I thought they did a great job. It was like, again, like you say, it's nothing remarkable by modern standards, but I can imagine watching this in 96, you'd have been on the edge of your seat.
Well, this was kind of at the time when ECW is innovating a lot of stuff, and you'll notice a lot of nods to ECW in this show, because around about this time you had Rey Mysterio Jr. and Psychosis tearing up at the ECW arena, and these kind of dives and head scissors were coming into WCW now via the Mexicans, via Conan and Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah, that's it. And like I say, I think this match would have been much better watching it at the time. I think right now, Eddie was always such a crisp, fantastic technical wrestler, but I never really latched onto him as a real favorite until he developed that swagger, which again wasn't that long after this. It was probably when he started doing the whole Latino world order thing, I would say, but he just looks kind of like a slightly mulleted, strange Texan American geezer at this point. And as great as he is in the ring, there's not a thing to latch onto.
I've actually got a really funny story about Babyface Eddie in WCW, if you want to hear it.
Yes, please.
Well, so as it turns out, WCW ran some market research, you know, which is a great way to gauge your audience when it comes to a wrestling promotion by making a test sample, fill out forms. And apparently, the most likable wrestler on the roster, in the opinions of whoever the hell they surveyed for this, was Eddie Guerrero, which seems to have factored into their decision to keep him as a bland white meat babyface for so long, and probably has something to do with the fact that Giovanni's calling him young man every 5 seconds. At this point, obviously, there's not much to either two characters, but it does, in a way, it ties a little bit nicely into some of the things we've said on previous episodes about the art of the opener, in that you don't waste a big marquee match with a storyline and pre-built fan interest on the opening match if you can avoid it. You've got the crowd ready and willing to be won over. You know, they're still hot. They're pumped for the show. So they've given them this match. And even though I agree, it took them far too long to build up. You know, if you accelerate the build of this match a little bit and trim 4 or 5 minutes off, you've got a tasty opener here. You can hear the crowd getting into it as things start to accelerate. Although you do, I don't know if you guys noticed that. You could see there's a certain point of the match where you know Guerrero, with his ability and his experience, he's just getting warmed up. Conan is flagging, and while the two pretty much went even Stevens and both looked up for it early on, in the second half of the match, it was clear who was carrying the match and who was dragging their ass and just trying to stall for time with extra poses and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing as well, I think, is, you know, these two know each other so well from Mexico. You know they're going to work well together. But the thing to bear in mind as well is that although this was the opener on the pay-per-view, we'd had, this was an era where they were doing the main event, which was essentially their version of Sunday Night Heat, for an hour before the pay-per-view. And we had four matches crammed into this main event slot. So the crowd were very much warmed up at this point, although obviously the pay-per-view hadn't started. It was a very odd setup.
That's true, and if I remember correctly, they're all very shitty finishes as well, so it probably took a little wind out of them, which might also explain, you know, normally a first match crowd can get through a slow burn and be up for it, but that'll explain why they had to be jolted back into it halfway through this first pay-per-view match.
Yeah.
You also noticed that with Conan, you know, we were talking about how he opened the door for the Luchadors, and obviously they'd be everywhere within the next 12 months and they'd be one of the hottest things on Nitro. But it's fair to say that this US title reign was pretty much a, yep, cheers, buddy, here you go.
It wasn't a memorable reign, was it?
They used to give it out as a gift, as a token, the US title, didn't they? I think One Man Gang, Kensei Sasaki. It was collateral for many years in WCW.
I was just about to say, in the video package that they showed at one point, you saw One Man Gang holding their belt. Yeah. So
speaks volumes.
Yes. Okay, so then we go backstage to Mean Gene, and this is one of those things that's just so brilliant to watch retrospectively. Mean Gene is shilling WCW's new live electronic chat on CompuServe, and we see the Big Show tapping away on a computer. We then have an interview with Colonel Robert Parker, joined by his ally Dick Slater. Parker's taking on Medusa in an intergender match later, but don't go thinking WCW are ahead of the curve here. This is not being portrayed positively. But we now we move on to one of the matches that has certainly stood the test of time and is remembered to this day. It is the grudge match between Lord Steven Regal and the Belfast Bruiser, Fit Finlay. So, Liam, how had this match, obviously these two know each other very well from Europe, but how had this match come about in WCW?
Oh man, so I've not gone back to rewatch this. I'm going off a memory that's, you know, we're talking, my last revisit of this particular angle would have been early 2000s, I think. But and I'll stand to be corrected by any listener or either you two guys, but if I remember correctly, there was a, you know, the Finlay made his debut. He came out of nowhere on, I want to say Saturday night, one of the lesser shows.
Saturday night, yeah.
And he just came out of nowhere and beat the crap out of Regal. And then he turned to the nearest camera and he went on a rant, which you never see anymore. You know, normally they just go, you know, they go into the middle of the ring, find the hard cam with a mic, and they address the audience. But he's just turned to the nearest cameraman and he's gone on some mad, angry rant for about 2 minutes while Regal's still lying there selling about how him and his people have oppressed the Irish people. And I'm not a British or Irish history buff, but from what I remember of it, and from what some of my friends were saying, they couldn't have been more wildly inaccurate trying to portray hostilities between Northern England and Belfast if they tried. So obviously, you know, when it comes to wrestling, I suppose you don't really need to have an astute geographical knowledge. Just get in the rough whereabouts, and, you know, I suppose in their eyes, Wales is technically like a city in England or something like that. So we had that. But the upside of it was that these two guys, as we all know, very familiar with each other, and they can go and do a pay-per-view match for any length of time and just beat the crap out of each other for 3 minutes, 13 minutes, 33 minutes. And that's exactly what they did here.
Indeed they do. So Regal comes out in his ornate 18th century style robe. He's accompanied by a servant called Jeeves. I've no idea why they name him, because he literally just comes out, takes Regal's robe and goes again. But Dusty and Shivani both think he's called Chives, which is obviously they're not clued up on PG Woodhouse in America. Finlay slaps Jeeves on his way to the ring, and Jeeves completely no-sells it. And given the brutality we're about to see, it makes the butler look tougher than Regal. And they basically say that, you know, he's a figure from Regal's past, as you say. what's noticeable is that Regal is selling big for Finley's offense right from the start. So this is partly a bit of respect because, you know, Finley paved the way for Regal in Britain and in Europe. But this isn't Regal's typical sort of comedy upper class toff selling. This is proper selling. And for all intents and purposes, Regal is plain old Steve Regal for this match once the bell rings and the Lord gimmick is dropped. I don't think the fans really know who Finley is, but he grabs their attention with his style, his very hard-hitting style. Some notable spots, Regal suplexes Finley over the top to the floor in the spot that they normally never actually do, always gets countered. And then Regal lands a Mick Foley-style elbow from the apron to the floor, and it's at this point that Schiavone kind of makes a comment about how Regal is very different here. Dusty argues over whether the two of them have fought before, but Heenan and Schiavone say that they've met in Europe probably. And it's worth noting that they've probably met more in the big German tournaments that happen on the continent each year than in the UK actually, but they would be very familiar with each other. And the commentators, they seem to be in awe of how stiff the match looks because it's not your typical American match. This to me struck me as one of two types of matches. Either the type of match you would have in a German tournament where you'd have the same venue, you'd have shows, you know, 20, 30 shows at the same venue, and you'd do a match to kind of wake up the regulars who've been to every night. Or a show that you do in a holiday season seaside town where the parents are dragged along by their son or daughter and you want to do something that's a bit stiff and legit to convince the cynical parents that it's a legit match. The end of the match comes when it spills to the outside again and right in front of the camera, Finley pops Regal's nose with a right hook. And there's blood all over Regal's face and chest. This is the complete opposite of the main event, basically. Schiavone says the crowd are stunned and he's right because there isn't much reaction. They fight up the aisle as the camera stays on wide shots. And then the two other blue bloods, Dave Taylor and Bobby Eaton, run out for an anticlimactic DQ finish. And Regal walks to the back, not with a crimson mask, but more of a crimson goatee from that broken nose. This was brutal. It was fascinating to watch, but brutal.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting in that on this pay-per-view, which is, you know, such an American pay-per-view from top to bottom, in all its themes, we got to see both the best and the worst of British wrestling in the sort of mid to late 80s. And I thought these guys took the crowd and the commentators and everybody completely by shock. You could only imagine that most of the people who put this match on hadn't seen these two guys in the ring together before. And they just beat the tar out of each other. Even I was wincing. And again, you know, you couldn't contrast it more with the Mexican style in the match before. Talk about an uncensored pay-per-view. These guys didn't need a gimmick to really bring that pay-per-view name home. I thought it was I entertained? Yes, to a point, but it was more morbid curiosity.
Yeah.
Of watching two guys just go like, right, how far are they actually going to go in this? I'd seen it before, but not for a lot of years. And I just thought I wouldn't go as far as say it was uncomfortable. Like, you know, I've seen some matches in the past where I was like, okay, this, I don't really want to watch this. It wasn't that, but it was just two guys. Clearly, you can almost imagine the conversation before they went out is they wanted to make a name for themselves. They wanted to stand out amongst all the hullabaloo and all the big names. And the best way for them to do that was to be so stiff with the names on everybody's lips afterwards. And I think with that one, and you know, mission accomplished, because no one watching at the time would have forgotten this. And you know, it would have taken them completely by surprise as well, because Finley, he looks brutal, but he's character at the time really didn't suggest that he was going to be this hard-nosed scrapper. I don't think he looked like a Freddie Mercury ripoff. He looked like your granddad going to a fancy dress party dressed as Freddie Mercury when he's coming down to the ring in that gear. But when, yeah, they just brutalized each other. Do you guys know whether these guys were on friendly terms back then, or was there some sort of rivalry?
No.
They were, so...
It was a carte blanche thing. They knew each other so much, they knew they could go snug.
Yeah, well, they really, really did. There's not many better examples of that. It was all credit to them, but it's not a match that I'd want to watch too often.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's along similar lines of Regal and Benoit, who are very close friends, and they often had, and it's a bit of an uncomfortable thing in hindsight, but they whenever they fought, they'd have headbutt contests, and the first person to make the other one bleed from the forehead would win the match, win the contest between them. So it's along similar lines, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's horrific, frankly. Yeah. But I think, you know, they stood out. They really made a name for themselves, and this was probably, there'll be a lot of guys in the back that would have been watching this match, and it would have been the thing, the first time they took notice of either of these guys in WCW. So I suspect that the end justified the means.
Yeah, I mean, what you said about Finlay, I mean, he is really that outfit, that look, everything is straight out of your All-Star Wrestling Hall, where it's not so much about the look and the image, but the work. And then as he stayed in America, obviously the look changed, and he became what we know him as today. Liam, your thoughts?
Yeah, as far as Finlay's look is concerned, he struck me around this era as someone who, the plan is for him to look like this hardened guy on the wrong side of the tracks, who can deliver exactly the sort of match he did, and the exact sort of backstory that he had with Regal for the purposes of this feud. But it was executed by his mum. You know, if I went to my mummy when I was 10 and said, right, can you dress me up for this thing? I have to look like a right hard nut. And she gave her best effort at dressing me like a tough hard nut. You can imagine it come out pretty much like that. So I don't know whose mummy, maybe it was Judy Bagwell, who's on the dressing staff. It strikes me as a job like that. It's quite...
I'll leave you to tell Finlay that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I'll be happy to. I might wait. You know, he must be about 60 now. If I wait till he's 80, I might have a chance.
It will still break your thumb.
Probably. It struck me as quite sad that this match really kind of, you know, it was lost on a lot of people in the audience. If you run, you know, you gave examples of this sort of match, Dean, for smaller, more intimate venues, and that makes a lot of sense. But this is, you know, but in the relative scheme of things, this is quite a large arena, and a lot of people in attendance are not going to really grasp how stiff, how brutal this is, and it's just two guys doing a brawl. For if you're sitting in the cheap seats, it's a shame. And I also thought because of that, and also in general, I felt like it ran quite too long. You know, they could have done, especially considering this is a DQ finish, and I'll get to that in a second. It's a DQ finish. It's one of the first matches I've had in this particular feud off, because I think they blow it off with a really violent parking lot fight on Nitro not long after this. That one was really famous. Check that one out if you haven't seen it. So to do this match with a DQ schmoz finish and everyone like 16-17 minutes, they could have done this in 6 and 7, beat the crap out of each other, 6-7 minutes, establish that they can beat the crap out of each other, don't lose the audience who are struggling to keep up as it is, and, you know, have them run in. And yeah, a DQ finish at fucking Uncensored. Unfortunately, they'd already set the bar for this. The first Uncensored was the year before at 95. And one of the things they set was this whole concept of a wild, anything goes, no disqualification sort of pay-per-view. This was, you know, you have lockdown in TNA where it's all cage. Before that, you had Uncensored, where the idea is, you know, there's no traditional rules here. Everything's a grudge match, everything's a brawl, anything can happen, everything's going to be allowed to let happen. It was supposed to be inspired by that whole ECW concept that was set in fire in 95. And they have a fucking shitload of DQ finishes every year, and they wonder why it was such a dismal failure, and this is another one, and it's such a shame.
Well, wasn't the main event of the first Uncensored Hogan and Vader in a strap match, where Hogan beat Ric Flair, who wasn't even in the match?
Yeah, and this is why the pay-per-view concept, and, well, you know, we live in an era where WWE can sell out several of their biggest pay-per-view events without lifting a finger to promote them because the name value is that good. And you know, they've launched this new event, and they, you know, the goal of any company is to try and get to that status where, you know, people see the name of the event on the ticket and want to buy that ticket, and straight off the box have killed it.
Oh, I should say that he beat Ric Flair, who is in drag. Sorry, forgot to mention that bit.
Yeah. Goes without saying, surely.
Why? Because WCW. Okay, so we have a backstage interview with Jimmy Hart and the Giant as they are preparing for Loch Ness, as he's called here later on. And the winner will be facing the world champion Ric Flair on Nitro the following night. We have more talking from the commentators. We then go back to Mean Gene again to shill the vaunted WCW hotline with one of his trademark sleazy come-ons. He then brings in Loch Ness himself for an interview, which, and again, British wrestling, interviews were never strong points of British wrestling. Loch Ness talks about how Jimmy Hart pulled him out of the Doomsday Cage match. Now, there are two legitimate reasons why Loch Ness was pulled out of the Doomsday Cage match. One was very sadly that he was shortly after arriving in America, he was taken ill, diagnosed with what proved to be terminal cancer. So at this point in time, he was being phased out of the company. However, there is another reason why he was pulled out of the cage match. And do you know what that was?
Go for it.
If you look closely at Super Bowl VI, which is the show before, where he comes down the aisle at the end of that match, you'll notice that he goes onto the steps but never goes into the cage. And the reason for this is because he was too big to fit through the door. That is absolutely legit. They couldn't put him in a cage match because they couldn't get him into the cage. He was that big.
Oh, my Lord.
Okay, so match number three, it's man versus woman, Colonel Robert Parker v. Medusa. Now, do bear in mind that a Steiner Brothers v. Nasty Boys match was bumped to the pre-show because this got on the pay-per-view. One thing that I just found it amusing was that they were playing up Colonel Robert Parker as this clueless non-wrestler, when in reality he's got decades of wrestling experience under his belt in the Southern Independence as Robert Fuller. And he's brilliant in that role because the way he takes the bumps and the way he sells the moves that he's supposedly never taken before, he is brilliant in that respect. Medusa slams Parker for a big pop. She drop kicks him to the outside, hits a dive from the top to the floor with the clumsiest ever landing. The end comes when she goes for a German suplex, but Dick Slater, who's Parker's second, grabs her leg. Parker then rolls over on top of Medusa and covers her just like that. And obviously, because Medusa is just a woman and is therefore weak, she is incapable of kicking out of this, and Parker wins. Remember, Medusa dumped the WWF women's title in the bin for this. At least it was mercifully brief, I suppose.
Sue me, but I quite enjoyed this. Bizarrely, when the premise was being set up, I just thought, oh, here we go. And I am not a fan of intergender wrestling, especially its modern incarnation at all. I just don't think it's right. So I really didn't expect that. But this was, it was comedy. It was fairly tasteless comedy, to be fair, but it was of its time. And like you say, Robert Parker just absolutely made this. You could tell he was a very experienced guy in the ring because of how he was handling everything.
Yeah.
But I thought he was absolutely fantastic playing that bumping buffoon.
He plays the role to perfection, doesn't he?
He really does, and it made the match. And, you know, contrast it. The obvious one to put it up against is from a few years later where you got Ed Ferrara against Medusa.
Oh, God.
And that's just obviously got all sorts of layers of tastefulness in it. But strip away all that and just look at the match itself, and goes without saying, you know, Ed Ferrara is a long, 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 long way behind a Robert Fuller. And that's the difference to me. It was short. It was brief. It was a funny bit on the pay-per-view. I didn't hate it. I thought it was okay.
I suppose I didn't hate it, but I just think there's surely a better uses of a talent like Medusa than this. That was probably my problem with it.
Yeah, yes and no. Like, you know, who, and again, I'm not familiar with this. Liam might have to weigh in for me on this, but in WCW at that time, who were potential opponents on the female side of things?
No, well, this is it. They pretty much did what WWE did when they had her as a lunge of blaze, and that was bring in literally one or two opponents at a time. That was the division. So she pretty much encountered the same problem she had over there. With regards to that comparison, I've got to say, comparing it, I remember that Medusa Oklahoma match. I wish I could get out of my head, but I can't. Yeah, there's a big difference in quality of the workers, or the one worker that's different, obviously. But unfortunately, there's one very serious, very telling thing that the two matches have in common, and that is who went over. You've got a situation like this in both scenarios. You've got the guy being overly chauvinistic, so a woman's place here, woman's place. Do you know what? In wrestling, that's fine. The key, when you have anyone being sexist, racist, any sort of unsavory dickhead character, is they have to get punched in the fucking face. They have to get their comeuppance, and yes, they have to get it. They have to get it without any complication. You have a bit of a chase, but you definitely don't have things where they lose the first match or few matches. You know, they evade their comeuppance for a little bit to build interest at best. Otherwise, it directly results in them getting punched in their fucking face, and that did not happen here. When I rewatched this pay-per-view, obviously I knew Hogan went over. Obviously I knew certain results, certain matches. I couldn't honestly remember until I rewatched it who won this match, and I just assumed it was going to be the buffoon getting his comeuppance, which is, it's entertaining. You do it right, and it's very entertaining. You've got a fantastic guy to do it in Colonel Robert Parker. And to go back on what you guys were saying, as I can't remember a non-Impact name, but as Ali, you remember Ali from last couple years in Impact TNA?
Yep.
As she has shown, the best person to play an inexperienced wrestler is a very experienced wrestler. Why have an inexperienced, just because the character's inexperienced, why have someone who can't do it? Because someone who's a seasoned pro can easily get that across, probably do a better job and not make it look so ugly. So he's done a fantastic job here.
Definitely. Yeah, I think what you said there about like the heel, I mean, it just reminds me back in, I think it was 2002, when I was a heel manager in the FWA, and I'd sort of just joined the FWA, and we did a storyline where I was basically the chauvinistic pig, and I was saying that we had a female ring announcer, and I was saying to her that you shouldn't be in here, you don't belong here, and I should have listened to myself because I ended up marrying her and getting divorced.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a hell of a chat-up line.
Exactly, but... But in the storyline, you know, I was like, oh, women don't have a place in wrestling, dum-de-dum-de-dum. And it panned out to the point where I ended up in a tag team match against Scott Parker and Nikita. And I got pinned by Nikita because it was the heel getting his comeuppance. Do you know what I mean? It's exactly what you said. And it was done properly. Whereas here, I think this was the last of the feud, I guess, between them. I'm not sure. But
that was it. I don't remember much else to it.
No. Right. Okay, well, after that, we are backstage with Lee Marshall, who, every time I hear Lee Marshall, of course, he was legitimately the voice of Tony the Tiger from the Frosties commercials, which is an awesome little bit of trivia that I always just think of. I always just wanted him to go, "You're great," to someone at the end of an interview. Never did, bastard. Next up's the DDPV Booty Man, who is the latest guise of... Ed Leslie. So, Liam, can you just fill us in on what this storyline's all about?
All right, so the first thing to remember is that this isn't really a DDP versus Booty Man or Ed Leslie feud. So this was a months-long thing between DDP and Johnny B. Bad, Mark Mero. You know, a feud where, you know, and sometimes you see it in modern wrestling where you can run the risk of getting sick of seeing the same two guys face each other every month. But honestly, in the case of Paige and Johnny B. Bad, I really felt like they enhanced each other and elevated each other and improved their general game by working closely together. The feud was, you know, I was always a fan of DDP's early gimmick in WCW. He went on to much bigger things, but I loved his cigar chomping bully mid-card heel, little bit goofy gimmick that he did. And this is basically the end of that chapter of his career, this pay-per-view. And he had the Diamond Doll. He had Kimberly, you know, one of the best looking women on television at this point, and playing a completely happy-go-lucky, lovely person all friendly and that, you know, that juxtaposition of the horrible heel and the smiling babyface valet, sort of very early Savage and Elizabeth-esque.
Yep.
And Bad had, you know, helped liberate her from the clutches of DDP, and then there was this whole story about apparently Miro was uncomfortable with the storyline because it portrayed him as stealing another man's wife, which was against his religion. But it did lead to a whole thing with Eric Bischoff that eventually led to an acrimonious exit where he became Wild Man Mark Miro in WWF. But for the purpose of this, the storyline is still very much in full swing and about to climax, because the thing is I think they did a bingo win where Kimberly won millions of dollars, DDP managed to act like it was his win, blew half the money, and half the money remained, and he was going to wrestle Bad in a match where if he won, Kimberly had to come back by his side, and he got all the money that was remaining, and if he lost, he would leave wrestling altogether. And then all the shit happened with Bad, and we had the Booty Man coming. And yeah, so what unfolds is not two very talented, under the right circumstances, very familiar opponents, but one musclehead who has to be on the fucking pay-per-view because his best mate is in the main event. And, you know, a guy who's not quite the DDP we know and love, having an overly long match.
Yeah, you touch on Ed Leslie. And I mean, this was the thing that WCW were never, ever able to find a gimmick for Ed Leslie. It was comparable to Brutus the Barber Beefcake. But obviously, they always kept him on the books to keep Hogan happy. So, I mean, he floated around as a heel and as a face. He was, I mean, there's the Butcher, the Booty Man, the Zodiac. I'm probably missing some others as well.
Get this, Dean. He came in as Hogan's buddy, flat out. When Hogan first arrived, he was his buddy, Ed Leslie. Then it turned out he was a mole in his camp. Mystery attacker, wearing a mask and sabotaging him while acting still like his best friend. That led to the reveal and probably the worst Starrcade main event ever.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Which is where he was the butcher because he butchered the friendship, wasn't it?
Yeah. Then he kind of morphed in because, like, he was with Kevin Sullivan, who was right from when Hogan showed him WCW. Kevin Sullivan was anti-Hogan and turned on his brother Dave, so he was very much in that camp anyway. So he ended up on Kevin Sullivan's side as the Butcher, and that morphed into the Dungeon of Doom, where he became the Zodiac, and I think a couple of other gimmicks all in one go. And they decided to run a story on where, in fact, he was a spy that Hogan sent into the Dungeon of Doom, you know, after having him sabotage him for six fucking months. And it leads to a just cycle getting back to being a smiling baby face and winning matches like this.
Jesus. So let's move on to the match, I suppose. DDP, I've got to say, he's paid attention to the gimmick because, yeah, he looks dishevelled, he looks messy, he's wearing plain purple tights, they look a bit saggy and old.
And he was wearing, like, mink coats and that when he took the money, and he was, like, coming out with all expensive gifts and expensive fur coats and stuff like that. And now he's like this. If you saw, like, the TV shows around this time, which I did, I only did retrospectively, to be honest, but if you catch any of it on, like, Daily Motion or anything, or on the network, it's really good character work from Paige.
I mean, the thing is that on the surface, you know, a guy who's lost all his money, down on his luck, it should make him the baby face, but, you know, he's the heel here.
Give it time.
It's 1996. Booty Man looks right out of the 80s with the headband and the mullet and the tassels. Every move DDP makes gets turned back on him. He's down on his luck. I compared him to, like, a wrestling version of Wile E. Coyote from the Roadrunner film, you know. Midway through the match, Kimberly comes down to the ring, all smiles, wearing colours that match the Booty Man, bizarrely wearing a tutu. She's cheering him on, but she's saying things to the camera like, he's so cute and I want him to be my boyfriend, to make her sound like she's got the mental age of about 12 when she's actually a grown woman of 27, because yet again, WCW don't know what to do with women on their roster. The match goes way too long. Everyone, I think, loses interest, myself included, when I was watching this. DDP ends up calling Kimberly up onto the apron, plants a kiss on her. She slaps him. He runs into a high knee from the Booty Man to lose the match. Yep, a high knee, not like not your Daniel Bryan knee or anything like that. The high knee that like Triple H uses as a transition move. That was his finisher there.
Yeah, but do you know why, Dean?
Why?
Say the finishing move.
High knee.
What's high his name? Knee.
What's the character's name?
I've just got it. Heine. Yeah.
I genuinely thought we were going to spend the remainder of the podcast on that.
I've just. It's taken me 22 years, but I've got it. Yes, DDP must leave wrestling, apparently.
He'll be back on the next pay-per-view, don't worry.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, this is, you know, don't forget, this is the promotion that had Ric Flair lose in 1994, a loser must retire match, and he's in the main event, and he's the current reigning world champion at this point. So, yes, the Booty Man, and Shivani says the Booty Man keeps Kimberly because obviously women are possessions. DDP must leave wrestling, and no wonder Kevin Sullivan got fucking divorced. Paul, did this keep your interest?
Kimberly kept my interest. No, I'm only joking. No, it was dreadful. I echo Liam's thoughts on Diamond Dallas Page. When he first came out, I'd forgotten all about this bingo win gimmick. Bingo wing, bingo win. I thought, why the hell does he look so disheveled? What, you know, has he completely lost the plot? And obviously when I sort of recalled it, it became so obvious, and it just, he played the part really well with his frizzy hair and his like his unkempt appearance. I thought, fantastic. Unfortunately, he was in there with the Booty Man, and Ed Leslie is not going to do anything for anyone. You know, he's a poor stand-in for Mark Marrow. You said it best, mate. He's only there because his buddy is in the main event. He's the only reason why he ever had gainful employment in wrestling. There's just nothing to this at all, is there? There's no point. There's no consequences ultimately, and it's an absolutely dreadful bore of a match that was about as uncensored as my son's nursery school world book day. It was just an absolute nothingness. So, you know, and it's funny when you look back again and look where DDP was just a few short months later. If we go back in time and I could offer you guys odds on DDP becoming the biggest babyface in WCW in 18 months, would you have gone anywhere near that?
Nope.
It's funny how karma does sometimes work in good ways. All these years later, you fast forward, DDP is the head of a tremendous million-dollar company, making people's lives, including my own, for the better. And Ed Leslie is getting stopped because he's got packets of coke so big people think it's anthrax. Karma will get ya.
Should I tell you a great Ed Leslie story?
Please do.
I was told this by Chris Hero, Cassius Ono, a good friend of mine, when we were doing some indie shows. He said that it was about a month before he'd come to England. He goes, I was doing a couple of shows, a couple of weekends, somewhere, I can't remember what it was now, but basically Brutus the Barber Beefcake was booked on both of these shows across two separate weekends that Chris Hero was on. Another person that was on was, do you remember Zach Gowan?
Yep.
Yes. One there, yeah. So basically, on weekend number one, Ed Leslie is introduced to Zach Gowan, and he's like, he watches the match and he says to Chris, oh my God, man, look at that. It's a dude, he's got one leg and he's wrestling. That's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. He is in awe of how Zach Gowan is basically, you know, overcoming this huge disability of only having one leg and producing great wrestling matches that are probably much better than Ed Leslie could ever produce. 1 week later, they're all on the same show again. Ed Leslie's watching this match and he says to Chris Hero, man alive, have you seen this guy? He's got one leg. It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And Chris Hero goes to him, yeah, he was on the show we were on last week. He goes, was he? And Chris's like, dude, he's only got one leg. How many other wrestlers with one leg have you met before? Yes, it's the same person. In the space of a week, Brutus Beefcake was so fucked up that he'd forgotten every meeting Zach Gowan 7 days previously.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yep. Don't do drugs, kids.
Yeah. As far as this match goes, it's such a shame with when you consider the fact that Leslie has pretty much fallen into I wouldn't say it was a great storyline, but obviously the work was put in. DDP and Johnny B. Badd are putting so much work into this. Kimberly as well, who's doing her absolute best, despite being, as you said, portrayed as a piece of meat that gets traded around. And he's come into this. The match has got that story. It's got that interest. And if they'd have cut it in half, I think even Leslie could have avoided screwing it up. But again, it's one of several matches that just goes way too long. Considering, as you pointed out, of all the matches that got put on the pre-show, on the main event, Steiner's Nasty Boys, just give these matches their proper length, and have those two teams come out for 15 minutes and do what they did to each other at Halloween Havoc 1990, when they beat the ever-loving shit out of each other in one of the few matches I've been proud to show to non-wrestling fan friends that went down great with them. And we're missing out on that for this.
Yeah. And we also had Jerry Lynn, or Mr. JL as he was called, against Dean Malenko. That was also... that was also on the pre-show.
Yeah.
But okay, let's move on. So we have a backstage interview with Lex Luger. And he's talking about how he's been put in the cage match by Jimmy Hart in place of Loch Ness, and his usual tag team partner Sting is going to be in a street fight now with Booker T. It's very confusing as to who's meant to be the face, but this will all come together later on. We'll go to you for that later, Liam. It is now time for Giant versus Giant. We knew it's not going to be a classic. The commentators tee us up for it not being a classic. It only goes 2.5 minutes. It is the Giant versus Loch Ness. So Loch Ness, for British fans, will be very, very familiar with him, and literally a household name as Giant Haystacks. Billed as 6'11" and 45 stone, about 650 pounds. By this point in time, he is, I think, 49 years old. He is, you know, he is well past his prime. And he has been diagnosed with cancer, and he is being written out so he can go back home to England for treatment. He trips up over a cable on his way to the ring, and he also has the music that we later identify with Rey Mysterio, which we've spoken about in the previous episode. The Giant has Jimmy Hart with him. To me, just as someone who grew up watching Giant Haystacks in the UK, it's really odd to see him looking up to someone who's taller than him or getting a boot into his throat. Giant takes a very impressive looking bump over the top rope when he misses a dive into the corner. And it's amazing how young and trim he looks here. Loch Ness hits the big elbow, but he then goes for one more, which the Giant moves for. And I'm not entirely sure if he was supposed to move on the first one. Giant then kicks him in the chest, which knocks him down. And the thing with Giant Haystacks was always, if you knocked him down, he couldn't get up again. And after a horrible looking leg drop, the Giant gets the pin. And as far as I am aware, that was Giant Haystacks' last ever wrestling match as well. So,
wow.
Short but sweet. Paul, what did you make of this one?
Rather than concentrate on the match, I want to talk about the interview. It was... Let me tell you a little story. When I was a kid, I was a WWE fan through and through, a WWF fan. That was pretty much the be-all and end-all for me. And I had a mate at school called Johnny Byrne who used to tell me... He used to watch Nitro on TNT, and he used to tell me about it, what happened. And I distinctly remember walking across the school playing field one day, and he was trying to recount Uncensored 1996 to me. And you could probably imagine how that went. But the reason I mention that is because John's dad was also called John. He's passed away now. He was an absolutely wonderful bloke, but he scared the shit out of me as a kid. He was a big, scary, typical dad of a northern dad, like out of Kez or whatever else.
Right.
And he was a top guy. But when Giant Haystacks Loch Ness was doing his interview before the match, and he was calling Jimmy Hart, hey, you Hart, I just thought that was so out of place in America. It's so Morecambe. And it totally reminded me of Johnny Byrne's dad as well. That's exactly how he would have been. I just thought it was absolutely wonderful. It really put a smile on my face, even though it was a dreadful interview. So, yeah, that was about 90 seconds, 2 minutes that I've managed to avoid talking about the match. Probably for the best. It was obviously diabolically bad. But what tickled me is that on the surface, it was a number one contenders match. So, technically, Loch Ness was only one win away from a match with Ric Flair on Nitro.
I'll tell you something, I'd have loved to have seen that out of some kind of morbid curiosity, because, I mean, bear in mind, Ric Flair managed to get a passable match out of Elegante a few years previously in WCW, and obviously Giant Haystacks Loch Ness was, you know, was a hell of a lot more experience. He's got about 20 years, 30 years experience under his belt at this point in time. So it would have been something I'd been very, very curious to see. But you're quite right. Yeah, this doesn't need to have anything more than Giant versus Giant.
I could book for you exactly how that Loch Ness Flair match would go. The bell would ring, Flair would try and avoid Loch Ness as he stalks him. He'd duck a wild swing, get some chops in. Loch Ness would stare at him. Ric Flair would sell, having his chops no-sold like he'd been shot. Would run around the ring a little bit, would probably get sent into the corner for a Flair flip, come into a clothesline and a Flair flop, and then would trip him up, and as you say, wouldn't get up from being tripped up. It'll be feet on the ropes, 1, 2, 3. I'd give him about 70 seconds to execute that, and it'd probably get 2.5 stars.
I mean, the thing with WCW here was the way... I mean, when Giant Haystacks in the UK was a huge, huge draw, and a legend of British wrestling. It was never about, you know, great technical matches. It was all about the drama, the circus freak show side of it, you know, when you were there live and saw the size of the guy. But basically, his matches were generally brief, and it was all about trying to, if you're the babyface, if you could knock him down or get him over the top rope out of the ring, you were going to win the match or win the fall, because if he went down, he didn't get up. And similarly, if he dropped that elbow on you, you were finished. Literally, nobody ever that I can remember beat that elbow drop, because he wouldn't pin them. He would just get them knocked out. In British wrestling, you'd have a knockout. As soon as he comes to WCW, the very first thing they get him doing in his very first appearance is, I think, he drops about 5 or 6 of these elbows. And it's like the one big thing that he's got, they've just kind of spunked it up the wall in the first minute. So there's no longer any drama to this, because you've just seen him do it 6 times. And it just absolutely baffled me.
Yeah, obviously in WCW speak, when they acquire a talent like Giant Haystacks, what they're looking at is just the guy for Hogan to gobble up. There's no long-term plan here. There's no attempting to use the monster to draw. They just want someone to feed to Hogan. And that's exactly what would have happened if it wasn't for his unfortunate turn of health.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. When you watched the Haystacks match, you're kind of on the edge of your seat, nervous, because you didn't want the babyface who you were supporting to get squashed by him, basically. And that was pretty much the story of every Giant Haystacks match, apart from obviously when he fought Big Daddy.
Yeah, it's like that great story Paul Heyman relayed, I think, on the Stone Cold Steve Austin podcast, about how he would give someone like Mark Henry a side headlock as a finisher. You have him apply that, and the guys in it sell it like their heads literally being crushed. Within a couple of months, a side headlock is a finisher, as long as it's pulled off by someone who looks like he could cripple you with a fucking side headlock. And as you said, like he's got the girth and he's got the arm.
Yeah. Okay. It's time for our Chicago street fight. How the hell have we ended up, Liam, with Sting and Booker T teaming up, and Luger, who is Sting's World Tag Team Championship tag partner, in the heel team in the main event?
Okay, so bear with me, because this is a detailed one, and you know what? It's not all because WCW. It's not all shit. Some of this was very enjoyable storytelling, but unfortunately not all of it. And when it was shit, oh my word, was it shit. So, you've got Sting and Lex Luger, your tag team champions. The situation between them is as old as the name World Championship Wrestling itself. You know, best friends, bitter enemies, all that stuff. And when Luger came back 6 months before this, he made that shock appearance on Monday Nitro.
Yeah,
it was played up. You know, him and Sting go way back. They've had their feuds, but they're mates, they're friends, they're compadres, they're brochachos, and they won the tag titles. It was also apparent that Lex Luger was still a piece of work like he was for most of the time in WCW NWA. And he turned on, I think he fell out with Randy Savage and turned on him, and they had a feud, and he didn't like Hogan, so he attacked Hogan, and you know, he was obviously part of this alliance to end Hulkamania. But all the while, him and Sting are great. You know, he doesn't attack Sting. He doesn't have a bad word to say about Sting. Sting's his mate. He just hates all the other baby faces. He might have Jimmy Hart as a manager, but he likes Sting. He might be a devious bad guy. He might be an absolute bastard. He might be a self-obsessed dickwad like he normally is, the Lex Luger, the character, and probably Lex Luger backstage this time. But he was self-involved and Sting-involved. But while they're having their tag team title defense, this, that, and the other, you know, and they've got quite a tag team division. They've got the Steiners, the Road Warriors. You know, a lot of these guys are Sting's friends, and they're all trying to wake Sting up to this, but he's like, no, Luger's my friend. He's done nothing to me. What he does everywhere else is his business. And he was falling out with these guys, and it led to a situation where the Road Warriors fell out with Sting, beat the crap out of him. So Luger is incensed, apparently, that they've done this to his mate over an issue with him. And he's gone, right, you're from Chicago, I'm from Chicago. Sting can bring it like he's in Chicago. Let's have a Chicago street fight. So it's set for the pay-per-view. Sting and Lex Luger versus Rowell. Chicago street fight. One problem, suddenly Luger has to do something else. And now, this was the beauty of their storyline, is he was blatantly stringing Sting along and doing things like this all the time, but he'd always have a convenient excuse. Jimmy Hart signed me up for this match. As I said earlier, their storyline machinations about the changing personnel and to protect Lex Luger from a match that he pretty much set up himself but didn't want, the character. Jimmy Hart has bumped Loch Ness, pissed off and fallen out with Loch Ness. He's out of the Jimmy Hart's first family or whatever he's called at this point. He's out just to keep Lex Luger happy and to stop him from having to do this match that he doesn't want to do against the Road Warriors. He'd much rather do the match where he's up 8-2, if you catch my drift.
Yes.
So Sting needs a match is set. Sting needs a partner, and Harlem Heat come up, who are bad guys. So, well, you know, Road Warriors pretty much acting like heels. They've fallen out with Sting and Luger. Steiners are fallen out with Sting as well, I believe, at this point. And Harlem Heat were never their friends in the first place. But Booker T's come up and going, I'll be your partner. I want to get on the pay-per-view. And if I help you win, we get a tag title shot. So I've got a mutual goal here. There's your storyline going into this match. And I loved it. I thought the premise was great. It's a sort of storytelling that, you know, it was a bit ahead of its time at this era. And it's a sort of storytelling you just don't see in WCW. Unfortunately, as we've discussed before we come on the air, it didn't quite pay off in the match. Mostly because the match went 30 minutes and because of other things.
Exactly. Thank you very much for that. It makes a lot more sense now. And I guess, yeah, it's one of those things you can relate to real life. You know, there's people all the time, you know, in work, in friendship or whatever. Yeah, you got someone refuses to see anything bad in. So I can see where they've gone with that. Now, I suppose the other thing to remember with this is that, and I mentioned it before, but this is the era that ECW is making headlines, especially with wild tag team brawls featuring specifically Public Enemy and the Gangsters, and you had the Bruise Brothers and the Eliminators and other people all in this time as well. So this, I think, is where WCW is trying to kind of take a bit of that zeitgeist as such. The problem with this is it's a street fight and there's far too many wrestling moves, complete lack of intensity. And I mean, one WCW street fight that really stands out in my mind is, do you remember Doom against Barry Windham and Arn Anderson from Starrcade 1990?
Yes.
And I remember this very well because it was one of the few WCW pay-per-views that was released on VHS that you could buy in like Virgin Megastore or HMV or somewhere. So I watched it a lot. And that was a really short, like 7-8 minute long bloody brawl. And that was one of the things that made me see this new company, WCW, and think how great they were. And I much preferred them to WWF. This wasn't anything like that. This is Falls Count Anywhere, but we've only got one referee, which is a decision so stupid that even Tony Schiavone mentions it, because the ref can only be in one place at a time. I'm not going to go into the details of this because it is just 30 minutes of plodding wrestling stroke brawling. You know, at one point, Sting heads off backstage and returns with a pair of brooms. because he's gone street. The end of the torture basically comes when Booker T walks off. He's pursued by Animal. A backstage camera finds them brawling backstage with Lex Luger standing nearby minding his own business. Luger gets accidentally hit, and so he hits Animal back. Then Stevie Ray appears out of nowhere. They both attack Animal. They tape him to a post backstage as Luger goes crazy. They could pin him, but the ref's still at ringside, so obviously they can't. Stevie Ray races to ringside, nails Hawk in the back with a chair. Booker pins him for the win. And as we've said, this took half an hour and went longer than the main event that featured 10 people. Oh, my God. Paul, how did you survive this one?
Man, I was so excited to see this match. The guys involved are first rate, aren't they? And I really like that whole Luger, Sting, best friends, either side of the heel face divide. I thought that was really well done. Enjoyed the quirks of it a lot. So when I came to sit down to this match, I looked at this pay-per-view card and thought, do you know what? At least this match is on there. The Road Warriors against Sting and Booker T. It was such a chore. It was as if they were just working it in slow motion, weren't they? And it was just, there was no drama. There was no rhythm to it whatsoever. It was just a series of moves done one after the other for half an hour. And it could have been any four guys in that position. There was no personality. There was nothing done that was dynamic that lesser wrestlers couldn't have pulled off. Could be any four. It could have been Skinner and IRS against Techno Team 2000. And it would not have been a different match at all. And then the finish where they wrap Animal. Bear in mind, Animal, one of the most powerful wrestlers in wrestling in kayfabe terms. They wrap his arms with some sticky tape around a post. And that's supposed to be what keeps him from breaking free? Couldn't they have rustled up a pair of handcuffs?
They did.
Did they?
Yeah, it was handcuffs. They showed it after the match. They show Animal still handcuffed to the post. They did such a poor job of picking up on the cameras while Jimmy Hart was doing a terrible job of actually putting the handcuffs on. And the commentators, who should know these things, and we've been through this, haven't we, Dean? You know, this gets brought up in meetings. All right, he's going to use handcuffs, put this over, you know, just in case camera doesn't pick it up, etc., etc. And yeah, you get a shot afterwards where Stevie Ray's adding a couple of chair shots for good measure, which I liked. But that's where you see he's actually been handcuffed.
It was, well, the commentators specifically say athletic tape.
They
so
do, yeah.
I stand corrected there. The idiocy of the commentators and the cameramen works me.
Why?
Because WCW. Sorry.
I was hoping all three of us would be involved in that, but Dean let the team down.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's as we've said before, you know, it's just the whole thing that on a pay-per-view, you would think that they would, you know, prepare and have a production meeting beforehand, but evidently not. Well, I suppose probably not, because Heenan and Mean Gene hadn't turned up to the arena yet. So.
Oh. But yeah, so man. So that Starrcade 90 match lasted 8-9 minutes, you said. By that point in this match, Hawk and Animal were gassed. They were blown up.
Yep.
So the middle portion of this match was particularly hard to get through, because they'd pretty much run through everything. Hawk had already no-sold two pole drivers, one on the floor. They'd already walloped each other with chairs. That's where they should have gone backstage, done this little segment, and be done with it. But no, they're having to try and drag through. You've got this, you know, they can't spring for two referees, but they can spring for this double camera, so you get two screens on one, trying to show you, say, Sting and Hawk go and fight in the crowd, and Animal and Booker are in the ring, and they capture both. There's one problem, they only ever use this fucking camera when all four men are in the same shot. So they're just showing a double angle one shot. It's tremendous.
Yeah. And then they go back to the one big screen for a bit, and then
when they lose them, and they have to cut to Sting wandering off to find brooms when there's chairs all over ringside that have just been used, no less. He goes and gets brooms, and they cut to one camera for that.
Yeah, and you see, this is where ECW were great at this, and this is another. See, again, we keep talking about things that are done well elsewhere that WCW then tried to copy and failed dismally because they didn't get it. One of the great things with ECW's wild tag team brawls of that time was there was a hard cam and there was a follow cam. That was it. So you only ever had one camera shot at a time, and they would cut from, you know, one camera angle to another. So if there was always something going on, and it, because it was cutting from one thing to another, it looked more, it came across more chaotic than it really was because of the way it was produced. Because, yeah, that was a great area of strength for Paul Heyman. Here in WCW, they've lost that by doing the opposite of just showing you too much.
Yeah, and I liked what they were going for with the finish to an extent, because, you know, Booker T does the old arm signals. He flaps his arms like, I'm done with this. And you can believe it, because he's kind of jumped in with an odd couple partner. So he's just like, I've had enough, go. And he's got Animal on his tail right from the get-go. So he's luring him into a trap. As evidenced by the fact that Luger just happens to be oiling himself up. It's very, very contrived. Not in a bad breaking a fourth wall way, but a deliberately contrived thing where Booker manoeuvres Animal into hitting Luger. And suddenly Stevie Ray's also there. What a coincidence. So this is clearly a trap by the member of the babyface tag team who's clearly a heel. And the tag team who are kind of playing a bit of a babyface role for the sake of it, but are natural heels, have been for the entirety at this point of their WCW tenure. So the three people who are dastardly at heart set up this trap to lure Animal out. Sting is in the ring, doesn't have a clue about any of this. He's fighting tooth and nail with Hawk. Booker T comes back, makes it a 2-on-1. So that makes sense. But of course it takes a 2-on-1 situation and Steve Ray coming back out with a chair and hitting Hawk for Hawk to actually eat a pinfall, because Hawk just won't take anything close to a clean win at this stage of his career.
And you know what's interesting was I was looking up at how old they were at this point, and they're a lot younger than I thought. Hawk was 39 and Animal was 35 at this point in time. And I just think that once they went to the WWF, they just lost that. Or they had a real aura of invincibility in the NWA as it was then. And, you know, obviously a few years have passed with Animal's back injury and everything, but I just think what the WWF did to them just killed their gimmick off.
But at this stage in their career, to be fair, they shouldn't have too much of an invincible aura, because, you know, the scene has changed, and you know, they have to be able to be portrayed as capable of losing to the tag team champions at the time, capable of losing to the Harlem Heat of Steins. You can still have them as a formidable gatekeeper, a formidable pay-per-view opponent, without constantly, when they're putting in performances like this and then you still protect them in the finish, you're not really protecting anyone.
Very much so. I mean, I know, Paul, I remember being a kid and seeing them come into WWF and being ridiculously excited because I'd heard about this team in the magazines from the NWA, and then they just kind of went from being these ass-kicking tag team to having a little dummy on a bicycle.
Well, to be honest, the Legion of Doom were the act that got me into wrestling. And I say the Legion of Doom because I saw them first in the WWF. So no matter how much I try and drill it into myself, they will always be the Legion of Doom in my eyes. So they were the act that I remember watching on SummerSlam 91, which was on at my friend's house in the background, and thinking, whoa, they're pretty cool. So to see, you know, they really have deteriorated in the space of 5 years. And as Liam quite rightly said, they can't expect to be treated the same way as they were before. But the problem is everyone is so, in awe is the wrong word, I suppose, but they're so sort of entrenched in the fact that the Road Warriors must go over that they forget that they've got this whole generation of new tag teams that they need to service. And they haven't got the balls or the nous to use the Road Warriors or the Legion of Doom to put them to make the new guys. And this whole run that they had in WCW for me was a bit of a wish-wash. Ooh. When did they leave so they left WWF in what, 92-ish, but then batted around. Hawk was injured, they went to Japan.
Oh, they split up for a few years, didn't they?
That's right, they did, yeah.
Hawk left the WWF days after or weeks after SummerSlam 92.
Mm.
Animal carried on for a little while in a tag team with Crush.
That's right.
Then Animal's back went. Hawk went to Japan where he teamed up with Kensuke Sasaki as the Hellraisers.
Yeah. Yep.
And then I think he then came back to America to the Indies, news in ECW and that, and singles. And then Animal came back around sort of, yeah, 95, 96 time, and they returned to WCW, I think.
And it was done, you know. The by that point, the legend of the Road Warriors was finished. And this match is such evidence for it. I didn't realise going into this. I fully expected to watch the Road Warriors of old kicking ass, really going at it physically. But it was like two listless old stagers whose heart wasn't in it. They were in it for the payday. They knew what they were doing, had little to no consequence. And they worked it as such. It was pretty sorry, to be honest. And obviously they went back to WWF in 97, early 97. And as excited as I was at the time, looking back now with the benefit of hindsight and without the passionate response, it was no better there. So, you know, really the tag team as we knew it in North America really died.
Yeah.
SummerSlam 92, I suppose.
But do you know what? We're talking about the attitude of the Road Warriors and living in the past. But when you've got Hogan in the main event spot doing what he's doing, can you blame them, really?
Not one bit. It's, I suppose, you know, what from what we know of the attitude of WCW throughout its time there, obviously Bischoff's in charge behind the scenes now, but you can't imagine he was that much more of a hard ass with the big time guy, with the big time main eventers. Than he was later on the line, and his predecessors were just as soft. It was, you know, these guys ran roughshod over things. So if Hogan's phoning it in and earning the big money, why shouldn't they? Fair play.
Well, that leads us nicely onto the main event. And one thing actually I was saying to Liam yesterday online was there's a really interesting article that was on WWE.com that I was linked to via Wikipedia, actually. Where they're interviewing Kevin Sullivan, they're talking about kind of this match and the Dungeon of Doom and how that came about and how he sort of recruited these people. And it was generally that it was all people that he knew Hogan had worked with in the past, that he was comfortable with and knew that he, you know, it was all basically with Sullivan's nose firmly up Hogan's backside, because we'll go through the members of the Alliance to End Hulkamania in a moment. And with some of the people, they've used the phrase "try to capture lightning in a bottle" twice and failed because it had come and gone. So the Doomsday Cage match, we have three tiers, three stories of cages. Hogan and Savage have to start at the top, beat the people in each level of cage before progressing to the next section. Shivani says like a gauntlet match. So we have Hogan and Savage, who are called the Mega Force, because they can't be called the Mega Powers, because that was WWF's trademark. But no one sold this to Randy Savage, because Savage is wearing his old Mega Powers tights.
He's wearing new Mega Powers tights. They were a different style to what he wore in when he was in the Mega Powers. He was in the trunks.
He was, yes.
These are all new, and you could tell because he never used to wear the black in the WWF. The black came into it in WCW, and these were black and yellow and red, I think, and these were newly made Mega Powers tights for Macho Man Randy Savage.
Jesus Christ. And no one said to him, Randy, we can't use that copyright and stuff. So the Alliance to End Hulkamania, we've got Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, who I feel really fucking sorry for having to be involved in this. There's a video package that's shown right at the beginning of the pay-per-view, and in a promo, Arn Anderson is doing his best to make it sound serious and make it sound legitimate, but he's fighting a losing battle. You've then got Meng and the Barbarian, who, we've discussed this before, they're both legit tough guys, but they've never been anything more than mid-carders and never been viewed as a threat to Hogan and Savage. We've got Lex Luger, who we've covered already. Kevin Sullivan, who really has no business in being in there, but is there because he's booking this shit. Then we have Z Gangster, who is Zeus from 1989, I think it was, wasn't it? The whole no holds barred thing with
Hogan. It was, and yeah. It was Savage who sicked him on Hogan.
Yes, SummerSlam 89, Hogan and Beefcake v Savage and Zeus. And all four men are in this pay per view, yay. So, yeah, we've got Z Gangster, who now is obviously 7 years older and literally hasn't wrestled in those 7 years. And a man whose name is now the Ultimate Solution, because they originally the final solution before someone told WCW you don't really want to name a wrestler after the fucking Holocaust.
And oh my God.
This was Jeep Swenson, who was also a member of the cast of No Holds Barred, who was just an enormous, huge power lifter who would drop dead 18 months later of heart failure at the age of 40.
But come on now, Dean, we have no real reason to link his heart failure at such a relatively young age to the fact that he's probably gassed out of his fucking mind.
I mean, if he was any smaller, he'd be a professional cyclist, wouldn't he? Well, I mean, what do we think of the lineup of heels there, lads?
Please, Paul, go first. I need to get my composure back.
The first thing I know. Firstly, how sorry do we feel for Michael Buffer?
Oh man,
you had to put a straight face on and cause. And let me just check my notes here. 1 second. What did Michael Buffer refer to this match as? He referred to it as. Come on, where am I? We are going to see an event like no other. Well, thank fuck for that. That's all I can say.
Do you know what? The very first thing I've written in my notes of this is, I wonder what Michael Buffer makes of this all.
Well, the first thing that struck me is when he was doing his ring announcements, he announced the Holocaust Man and Z Gangster, and they never turned up.
Yes.
They just didn't turn up. I was like, have I missed them? Has the structure obscured them? But no, they turn up later, presumably because neither of them have got the acting chops to stand there in a cage for 10 minutes looking menacing. By the way, Jeep Swanson was also in Batman and Robin, wasn't he? He played Bane in Batman and Robin in 97. So he must have survived just a couple of months later. And that's two abominations in 2 years that he was involved with. Well done, Jeep. But yeah, what a collection of misfits this was. You got Arn Anderson looking like he's going for a jog with his kids in his black sweatpants. But nobody tells Ric Flair that this is uncensored, and Ric Flair turns up in his trunk still. Ditto Lex Luger.
Sullivan.
Sullivan looks like a whack job. Anyway, it's almost like you've got the whole cage is like a gradient of heel credibility. So it starts at the top with the very professional looking wrestlers of the Four Horsemen, goes down to Kevin Sullivan, who straddles the line. And when you plumb the bottom and you've got Z Gangster and the Ultimate Solution, and you really are in, oh, what the fuck are you trying to do territory? I'm not going to comment on the rest of the match yet, but whoever put this lineup together just needs taking out the back and shooting in the face.
Oh, but it gets better than that. One thing I want to say, when you guys talk about Michael Buffer, and we've discussed, and I know Dean likes to discuss Michael Buffer and his massive pointlessness on these things, but I think he's like this with every pay-per-view, but Uncensored 96 made it click in my mind that Michael Buffer in WCW is Ron Burgundy before there was a Ron Burgundy, because he will just read anything off that fucking teleprompter and he won't care what he's just said. So if you're wondering how he's going to react to introducing something like this, he doesn't care. He cares about his paycheck, and I love that. That's exactly what he's done here. He will just read whatever's put on his cards and then get the fuck out of the arena. That's exactly what he's done.
I'm just imagining it now going, go fuck yourself, Tupelo.
Oh man, there's going to be all sorts of cross-reference potential there. The lineup you mentioned, Meng and the Barbarian, were not advertised for this, just showed up at the last minute. They said there were going to be two slots. One of those slots I was expecting to be filled by Brian Pillman.
I was just about to mention Brian Pillman because, yes, Shivani says, he asks where Brian Pillman is, and the answer is he's far, far away from this ship, Tony, because he knew how it would kill the reputation he was working hard at creating.
There is speculation over whether his medical excuse for not being able to do this show is legit or not, but either way, WCW found out just after they taped their last batch of TV, they had plenty of time to post, edit and remove the advertising that Brian Pillman was going to be there, and they decided to keep it in there. And to make it even more fucking obnoxious, they obviously they give the commentary team live free reign to just speculate that he is going to show up. And it does eventually lead to the only one credible kayfabe explanation that Brian Pillman is, after all, a loose fucking cannon and, you know, just no show. So I had that. And I think the next night on Nitro, Eric Bischoff touched upon, well, he still hates the Taskmaster because him and Kevin Sullivan had that balmy strap match that lasted 2 minutes.
I respect you,
before.
Booker.
Yeah. That graces our opening intro. So there was all that. But they still advertised him, which is repulsive.
Yeah. You see, the thing I always heard about that was basically Hogan had seen how Pillman was getting hot and so therefore wanted to beat him.
Yeah.
And Pillman was like, no way.
That may not have necessarily been directly what happened with this match. It may have been something to set up for like a Nitro or something later where they fought one on one. But yeah, that is what he was angling for. But yeah, by all accounts, whether it was related to that or not, this was going to be Hulk Hogan smashing through four jabronis from, you know, probably like guys of Dungeon of Doom, like Sullivan, Ming, Barbarian. Maybe they'd have brought in one of the two big roided goons as well, and he'd have smashed through them in 4-1. Apparently, get your head around this, Randy Savage was going to wrestle Chris Benoit on this pay-per-view.
Wow.
Now I would have paid money to see that. That would have been I'm not guaranteeing it would have been a brilliant match, to be honest, because it would have been intriguing.
Been better than this.
Oh yeah, it would have been the best match on the card, to all accounts. But just how it turned out would have been I imagine they'd have brought the intensity, I can guarantee that much. That would have been great,
yes,
to watch.
Oh god, yes.
But then, as I said with Regal Finlay, it's not necessarily going to translate into an amazing match, so you never know. But it just would have been an interesting thing to watch, unlike this show. Yeah. So yeah, yes. Hogan the Booker, not Kevin Sullivan, don't make any mistake about that, had it changed where him and Savage wiped through an entire squadron because Hogan, if we can make a subsection of that.
Well, Hogan and Savage both had creative control in their contracts, didn't they? So, yeah, they are pulling the strings here. So, again, we have the split screen so we can watch people wrestling in. I mean, the whole concept of this is just bizarre. It's at the back of the venue. It's dimly lit. Apart from the bottom story, you are walking on mesh fencing as opposed to a solid floor. So that makes any kind of movement very difficult. Plus, it escalates the risk of ankle and knee injuries hugely. The bottom level's got an actual ring set up in it. There's no explanation as to whether you have to pin both men to be able to head down to the next level or just one of them or how you get down. I was wondering at some point if the Booker had thought up this one there drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning, harking back to our last episode. But they also show a camera shot from within the crowd. And I'm genuinely wondering how the hell anyone in the crowd can actually see what's going on.
Well, here's an example for you of how little they can see what's going on. They did a so-called Doomsday Cage gimmick. It didn't take them long to be at the, they even fought to the actual wrestling rings used for the rest of the pay-per-view at one point. And at one stage, as they're beginning to do this, they got out of the cages, and I think it's Sullivan and Hogan are doing spots on the scaffolding rig that are used,
yes,
to climb the stairs going, yeah, up, where the valiant outnumbered babyface is trying to kick the conniving heel Sullivan off of a scaffold to his death. And they can't even get a pop from the crowd doing that because they probably can't see exactly what he's trying to do. They can't see that Hogan's trying to commit murder live on pay-per-view.
Also, the fact that Sullivan is bald, has long blonde hair and is wearing yellow trunks makes it look like Hogan is trying to beat up some midget clone of himself. So we start off Hogan and Savage against Flair and Anderson. This sort of general brawling where Hogan doesn't sell anything, ends up they throw powder in Flair and Anderson's faces and then just open up a trap door and get down to the next level. And apparently that constitutes beating them, although it's never been mentioned to us before. So they're now on level two, which is 2-on-4 because the Mega Force have to take on Meng and the Barbarian as well as Luger and Kevin Sullivan. And at this point, I am trying to imagine Loch Ness trying to perform while walking on mesh. Hogan gets a chain and shuts Meg and Barbarian out of their section, because there's another, the second tier, the second story is sort of divided off into two sections. Hogan does at one point lose his grip on the chain on the door, and the door opens up again. So Meg and Barbarian just have to stand there and pretend that they're still locked out. Hogan and Sullivan then get out of the cage and brawl on the scaffold, as you mentioned, Liam. They then walk down the level via the stairs at the side. I'm now trying to work out if that means Hogan's progressed to the final level to face the opponents who haven't yet shown up. I'm not entirely sure. This is never explained. Hogan and Sullivan then brawl on the floor, having escaped the cage. So what's the point of the cage? Savage and Luger somehow join them. We're not quite shown how, because they've decided to not use the split screens at the one point you really would want split screens. Hogan and Sullivan are now in the ring, as you say. The rest of the heels who were locked out have somehow managed to find a way and are coming down now, but then they disappear. So it's them, Hogan, Savage, Sullivan and Luger, with the other four men just deciding to head back to the dressing room, or two men decide to head back to the dressing room and two others haven't even shown up yet. So everyone who's still in this match is out of the cage and at ringside, but at least the fans can see what's going on. Then Ultimate Solution and Z Gangster show up for their couple of minutes in the spotlight. They march Hogan and Savage back to the cage. This is even worse than the rest of the stuff, because this is bad wrestling that's 10 years out of date. I don't think Hogan sells anything here. It's time for a recreation of the old Hogan Zeus stare down that no one really gives a shit about, because basically Hogan won that feud before, so there's no intrigue whatsoever because we've already seen Hogan beat him.
And he did lousy business the first time.
And he did bad business, exactly. Flair and Anderson then suddenly return to the cage to try and... I think they've just been sent in there to try and rescue things. That's what I think.
To do
there.
The job.
To do, well, I think partly call an audible to like rescue things. And Shivani says that they're supposed to be eliminated at the top, but seeing as no one really knows the rules to this, how we don't mention to know for sure. It's 2-on-4 again. Dusty keeps calling them the Mega Powers. He'll be getting a letter from Jerry McDevitt at some point. Then the Booty Man shows up and hands Hogan and Savage frying pans, just in case you weren't sure that they're really trying hard to capture the ECW zeitgeist of the time. Luger comes back in. He attacks both faces, puts on what's meant to be a loaded glove. He hits Flair instead, and it's quite interesting because Flair's holding Savage's arms behind his back. Savage ducks, Luger then stops and then hits Flair to make it look very much deliberate and probably part of a story down the line. This is the best bit. Hogan and Savage then escape the cage, but then they remember that they haven't actually pinned anyone yet, so Savage just pops back into the cage to pin Ric Flair, although it's hard to see if it is Ric Flair because the only camera that is looking into the cage has got Hogan standing right in front of it, because the position of the cage means there's no hard camera to look at anything. So basically, out of a choice of five wrestlers in the ring, including two people who are brought in specially for the match and will never be seen again, it's the reigning world champion who takes the pinfall, and Hogan and Savage have made every single top line and middle line heel look terrible. There are no more heels left for Hogan after this, and it's no surprise that Hogan's next pay-per-view appearance was the infamous Bash at the Beach 1996, where he turns heel himself. Paul, Liam, what did you think of this? Did it actually happen, or was I dreaming?
It's definitely a fever dream brought upon by your burning your hand. There is some sort of strange narcotics gone into your brain. No, unfortunately, this happened and someone created this. Liam, were you trying to say it was meant to be Hogan on his own in the original concept?
Yeah, apparently, according to the Observer, it was going to be Hogan against four schmucks and just wiping through them to keep Hogan
amazing.
Occupied / happy.
Amazing.
Yeah, I actually really think we should have told Dean it was a fever dream and that we watched the reality of Savage Benoit in the main event. Just to see how he reacted. His worst week would have got even worse.
I would honestly be, you know, the story about how this match came into being, you know, frankly, reading my shopping list out would be more entertaining than this match. But the story of how this match came about would probably be really interesting because, you know, is it Hogan's gigantic ego just getting completely out of control, or is it the powers that be at WCW running out of meaningful ideas to have their Superman run through. It's like when you look at the Marvel films, you establish whoever Captain America, Iron Man, whoever you want to choose, as being all powerful and able to beat a fellow supervillain in the first film. But then where do you go for subsequent films? You've got to keep escalating it and escalating it and escalating it. And if you've got a guy who's got creative control and you're not able to tell stories with nuanced characters who can show vulnerabilities, then this is where you end up. A doomsday cage of doom with Bane from Tower of Shit. Oh, it's inevitable. It's the product of a lot of coke done in Atlanta in the 1990s, a ridiculous Hogan contract, and it's got to be the nadir of WCW pay-per-view. Thankfully, like you say, when Hogan turned heel quite soon after, I started watching WCW just after this, and I was lucky. I missed all this shite. What I saw for WCW, in fact, my first ever episode of Nitro that I watched on TNT after Cartoon Network, by random coincidence, happened to be the very last one before Scott Hall turned up. So, until the WWE Network came around and I got to catch up on all this, I thought WCW was a beacon of fantastic quality. How wrong could I be? This was as bad as it gets in wrestling, because A, it's just shit, but B, it's been given the platform to show how shit it is. It's not like anything's buried away on the mid card or the lower card. This has had a structure constructed for it specifically to showcase its awfulness. But it doesn't get much worse than that, does it?
Do you think at the end of the show, they all went backstage, high-fived each other, went, yeah, good show, lads, well done. We really put a good show on tonight.
So Hogan's face, yes.
Genuinely, though, it's a great question. I'd love to know the answer to that. I would love to know what, because obviously there's going to be a whole bunch of guys back there who are, wrestlers, and who know how to run a company that would know exactly what they'd put on. But is there a bunch of guys back there? Is Eric Bischoff stood back there and a few others who genuinely think they've put on something groundbreaking and magnificent? I bet there was.
Yeah, I mean, what's going to be their barometer? It's not like they have these... there's a few guys in that company who in the position to change things that have those sort of standards, that sort of experience. But a lot of them, guys like Bischoff and a lot of the Turner execs involved, aren't going to be able to tell much, are they? So they just see Hulk Hogan doing his thing and assume everything's tickety-boo.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a dark time for WCW, and then it bounced back with, everything changed with the Hogan heel turn. I remember I was at university at the time, and I remember people when in the house I lived in would, come in and see me watching wrestling, and they'd see, hang on, is that Hulk Hogan? Has he gone bad? Oh my God. And it would get a genuine reaction out of people. So this was the lull before the storm, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is that Hulk Hogan didn't actually change much about him at all. He just happened to be portraying a heel, so everything he did in the ring actually looked apt, because he fought like a fucking bad guy anyway, with his back rakes and his cheating and things like that.
Yeah.
If you look really closely, as hot as the NWO product was, Hogan was just being Hogan. And he had the name value to help set it up. But make no mistake, he was still turgid to watch. And as things started to progress and the power struggles happened between himself and Nash, or Hall and Nash, I think it was definitely more Nash than anyone else, because obviously Nash made it all the way up top as the booker and put the fucking belt on himself at Starrcade. But as those things happened, you could see where the rift was the guys like Nash and Hall were like, well, we're the ones who actually brought the change, and you've hitched your fucking wagon to it.
Which, is your typical smart political Hogan. Because, okay. So that was WCW Uncensored 96, a legendary main event, I think you will agree, gentlemen.
It's, there's a place for stuff like this in wrestling, and it would be so boring without all this crap to look on, wouldn't it? Without the really bad, how could you know what really good is? So in a way, it's nice that the world has Uncensored 1996. And I'm lying to myself just saying this. I realise I'm trying to convince myself. It was just turgid, wasn't it? It was 3 hours of my life that I'll never, ever get back. Cheers, Dean.
Yeah. Yep, you're welcome, mate.
So, Paul, as our esteemed guest, would it make you feel better to maybe focus on something in 1996 that was considerably better than this? Because I do have it on good authority what you've picked as your entrance theme as the guest choosing.
Yes. I was a bit reticent to pick this because it seems a little bit obvious, but the more I thought about it, the more I really wanted to do, for a few reasons. Because for personal and sort of wider, I think there's an argument to be made to say this is the most important piece of theme music in the history of wrestling. Because frankly, as you guys are saying about how, what we're getting here with Uncensored 96, this was WCW. This incarnation of WCW was not touching the WWF ever. And if that competition hadn't have happened, where would the rest of, you know, would we have got Stone Cold? Would we have got The Rock? Would we have got the Attitude Era and all that entailed? Probably not to the same degree. And this, to me, this music is so vital to the whole aura of the NWO. I personally think WCW got so utterly lucky. There are so many things that should have gone wrong with the NWO that happened to fall right, that put them in the perfect spot. You know, the personnel of the group, it so close to wasn't being Hogan, the look of the group, the feel of the group. You hear about these stories about how those black and white interviews with the jump cuts, Hogan wasn't doing those right. You know, that was a happy accident. They were only being done because Hogan was trying to do traditional wrestling promos. And to me, the whole package of the NWO is the bow on it is this theme music. And it sums up the attitude of the group. Gave them that cool factor. As soon as that riff hit, you know, the new world order, you knew what was coming, and it suddenly meant excitement. And I think, you know, it was as important to that group as any individual member and any angle. And so to me, I would say, yeah, it's the most important theme music in wrestling history, because it played a massive part in creating the boom period and the competition that we enjoyed afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, Dean and I tend to go a little bit obscure with our own personal picks, but at the end of the day, this segment, this is all about the best of those three entrance themes, sometimes the best of the worst. You know, I will tend to pick something like Paul Orndorff's theme or something like that. But yeah, there is absolutely no limits to on the selection criteria, and it is nice to hear something that even a casual WCW fan will instantly recognise.
Apparently, it's called Rock House by Frank Shelley, according to Wikipedia.
Oh, and it's ruined.
Yeah, sorry. Although I do remember someone swearing blind that they once saw it featured on a film called Bambi's Juicy Hooters. So take that for what you will. It did always have that kind of vibe to it.
Oh, it was blatant porno music. I think every online writer at the time and just afterwards would be like, cue the porno music. And they're absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, was it Tom Zenk's theme sounded like it came out of a strip club or something?
Definitely, yes, definitely. But again, this, you know, for me, this music has memories, because as I said, you know, this, the NWO era was when I was living in student digs at university. I would be getting tapes of Nitro sent to me every couple of weeks. Me and one of my, I'd be watching it. My housemate was a sort of a bit of a wrestling fan, and he'd dip in and out. And that we all loved that music. That, as you say, it was you heard that music and your ears would prick up, and you knew that something big was going to happen.
And for me personally, it was like I said, I started watching WCW around this time. So if, for me, when if you give me a choice of a piece of music to sum up WCW, there's literally no other choice for me. This is it. It was either that or American Males, anyway.
Oh, But you'd been through enough shit, so you thought you'd go for something different.
Correct.
Love it. Okay, just before we go, let's WrestleMania parties going across the country, 22 different locations on Sunday, April the 8th. And you can check that out at facebook.com/HOWrestling or on Twitter at HO_wrestling. Is that right, Paul?
Absolutely phenomenal, Dean. It's lovely to do a podcast where I don't have to do the heavy listing on the plugin. So thanks for that.
Also, just want to mention we are available for free on iTunes and on Podbean because www.podbean.com. We are also have a part of the IWN, the International Wrestling Network family. If you sign up to that, normally it's $4.99 a month. That's £4.99, I think around about $6.50 in the US. You get access to a load of podcasts, but more than that, you get lots of independent wrestling from all around the world, including IPW, who I commentate for. And we've got a huge show coming up on March the 18th at the Clapham Grand with a double main event celebrating 25 years in the business. Doug Williams takes on his old foe Christopher Daniels, which should be fantastic. And we have a meeting between Jimmy Havoc and Jimmy Jacobs. Now, if you are listening to this and wanting to see what the IWN is all about, we have a special offer exclusively for our Because WCW listeners right now. It's valid until the 13th of June. If you subscribe and put in the discount code 20 Because WCW, that's all one word and all block capitals, 20, the figures 20, Because WCW, that will give you 20% off for 6 months. Can't ask for better than that. So all it leaves me to do is say thank you very much to Showbiz Paul Benson from Hooked on Wrestling for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as anyone can enjoy watching the Doomsday Cage match, Paul.
I've had a great time talking to you guys. Made up for the shower of shite of watching the pay-per-view.
And on behalf of my co-host, Liam Hatt, this is the Twisted Genius, Dean Ayer, saying thank you so much for downloading us. If you've liked this, please tell a friend. And we will see you very shortly for another episode of Because WCW.